here's what I'd like you to do. And it's going to be kind of tricky because this is different, all right? I want you to silence yourselves as much as you can, right? Not just not make noise, but kind of get your mind into a silent state. Listen as alertly and receptively as you can. And this is the really tricky part. Close your eyes when I ask you to. I promise I will not move from my seat. Nothing cold or wet or slimy will drop down from the ceiling onto you, though it is Halloween. So if you can close your eyes without falling asleep, of course, that's what I'd like you to do, and I'll let you be the judge of that. So what I want to try to do is tell you a story. I want to try to paint a scene in your minds, maybe in your hearts. It's a story of darkness, and it's a story of loss, and it's a story of pain, but it's also a story of light and adoration and joy. How it can be both of those at the same time without falsifying either is a mystery to me. But it is both. Pain, darkness, loss, and light, adoration, and joy. The story I'm going to tell you is by an artist who by all rights should have just given up. He should have slipped into obscurity. He should have cut his losses the way grown-ups do and slipped into old age gracefully, but he didn't. At some level, he probably believed that he must not do that. He wrote in a darkness that I can't imagine. It's a darkness that it hurts to think about. All you English majors probably share one thing, which is you love to read. In that darkness, there was no reading anymore. I'm sure that hurt him a great deal, too. But he didn't deny the darkness. He didn't try to hoard or hide his light inside the darkness. He never forgot his quest, even though he traveled to his own encounters with despair. He battled doubt all his life, but he also practiced the habit of belief. He believed in himself. He believed in his own gifts as a thinker, as a poet, as a leader. And he also believed in God. But this is a God that many people said to him had punished him for his sins. Many people told him that God had made him blind because of the opinions he had held and written about, and that now he was being punished, alone, rejected, and in the dark. So let's join him. Close your eyes, please. It's the winter of a year early in 1665. A 56-year-old Englishman lies alone in a small bedroom in a small cottage about 30 miles northwest of London. He's gone there to escape the plague that periodically ravages England's capital. His bedroom in this plain, snug house is about the size of a small dorm room. Sparely furnished, it has rough plaster walls and a wooden floor. There's a fireplace in the room, of course, but the fire has probably been out for several hours. Earlier in the evening, friends came to dinner. This man is a very popular dinner companion with a wry and somewhat satirical sense of humor. But now everyone has gone home except his wife and a servant. Everyone in this cottage is asleep but him. This man doesn't sleep well at night, partly because of his gout, which attacks him from time to time with excruciating pain, and partly because night and day are no longer opposites for him. Since for the last 13 years or so, he has been almost completely blind. He sees just about what you see right now. A kind of ashy whiteness with an occasional flash of light that has grown dimmer and much less frequent over the last decade. As he went blind, his vision became distorted. He suffered terrible headaches. His head was full of pain and weariness as his eyes failed, and he gradually confronted the fact that he would no longer be able to read. This loss was catastrophic, on a level with Beethoven losing his hearing. Ever since he had learned to read, this man had read voraciously. His father paid sitters to stay up with him as he read by candlelight far into the night. His favorite English authors were Spencer and Shakespeare, but he loved all literature, all philosophy, all history, all science. He just loved the work of turning symbols into meaning and turning meaning into symbols. But now, every book is a blank book to him, as if the words had been erased from the pages. Here he lies, then, triply alone. He's alone in the room. He's alone in wakefulness. He's alone in his blindness. He's also a member of a now despised political movement. 5 years ago, he nearly lost his life. He was jailed for many weeks while he waited to learn whether Charles II would order him beheaded. This new king had come to the throne in 1660, when the parliamentary republic led by Oliver Cromwell collapsed. England, weary of its experiment in self-rule, asked Charles II to come back from exile and be king. That's what we call the Restoration. When the English Commonwealth crumbled, those who had supported it were in grave danger, especially if, like this outspoken old man in this dark room, they had argued in favor of beheading Charles I, who did in fact lose his head in January of 1649 at the climax of the English Civil War. So this old man in this dark room, who never shrank from saying exactly what he thought, even when he thought several apparently incompatible things at once, was in danger for several years after the Restoration, even after he was freed from jail and his life was spared. Knowing this man, we might imagine that part of him would rather have had a glorious execution than the exile and mockery he now endured. Once he had been a great statesman, a political leader. Now he had no more power or influence. Now some of his people called him traitor instead of patriot. So we imagine in this dark room this blind old man who has suffered great political losses and great personal losses too. He's lost his job. He's lost his health. He's lost his vision. He's lost his political standing. To a certain extent, he has lost his freedom, which is a particularly painful loss, since John Milton loves freedom above all things. And he's endured other painful losses as well. He's lost his first two wives, both of whom died in childbirth. He lost his only son, John, probably because of poor care by the nurse, care the old man could not supervise adequately, because his wife was dying, and by then, he was blind. He's probably lost the affection of his oldest daughter. His second daughter was born with a mental handicap, probably some form of mental retardation. He may never have been able to have a real conversation with her. But all was not lost. His third daughter, Deborah, named for a powerful woman who was judge of the Hebrew nation, was still with him and a source of great comfort. And he still had friends who dared to risk kingly displeasure and came to visit him. Indeed, many visitors from foreign lands came expressly to visit and talk with this old man, who was reputed to be the most learned man alive. It was worth a long journey and a lot of trouble just to converse with him. And the old man still had his music, a gift he had inherited from his father, who had written very well-regarded compositions for church and court, including a madrigal in honor of Queen Elizabeth. Our poet, John Milton, Jr., had himself learned to play the organ quite well, perhaps tutored by his father, and he had a very pleasant singing voice. In fact, John Milton loved music so well that he would often sing and play during his gout attacks as a way of fighting the pain. And for all the pain and loss and darkness, his life is a wonderful life still. His days are spent listening to the Bible, in Hebrew or Greek, of course, and works of literature from many nations read to him in the original languages, of course, and in moderate exercise and often stimulating company. But there comes a time, even in the best of days, when those friends and loved ones who can still see will close their eyes and seek their rest. And the old poet is once more alone. So in a wet and chilly English winter, this old man lies awake in this dark, still room in this silent house. What is he doing? Is he thinking of his losses? No doubt. Is he grateful for what remains? Of course. Is he in pain tonight? Perhaps. These things would be enough to keep any of us wakeful. But the primary reason John Milton lies awake on this night is something else entirely. He lies awake writing poetry. In fact, he's finishing up his masterpiece, the greatest poem ever written in our language, the only poem that can be compared with Dante's Commedia, Virgil's Aeneid, or Homer's Iliad or Odyssey. He's lying awake, finishing up Paradise Lost, writing it line by line in his mind, 100 lines at a time, revised to 30 or 40 by daybreak, at which time his amanuensis, his scribe, will come to take down John Milton's recitation of the new lines in this mighty work, a work that John Milton believed himself born to undertake, a work he had planned for and thought about for 40 years, a work he had publicly promised the entire world he would do. And now, when the whole world expected him to retire and lick his wounds, and who could blame him? He is instead writing that masterpiece. I'd like to read part of it to you now from the beginning of Book 3 of Paradise Lost. Satan has just begun his journey from hell to earth, out of darkness visible and toward the sun. Satan hates the light, because it reminds him of the heaven from which he fell. The poet, by contrast, who has every bit as much reason to hate the light, because he can no longer see it. In fact, he has even more reason than Satan, because he had been faithful. He had not rebelled against God. This poet, who has every reason to hate the light, does not curse it. Instead, he praises it. Praises the thing he has lost. Praises it despite the fact that what he most loves to do, read and write, are now impossible for him to do without help. Milton's risky venture is to know the light, to understand it, to imagine its mysterious power and communicate that power to us. The poet has been in hell with Satan for the first two books of the epic, and now he escapes it with Satan and flies with Satan towards the sun. And because this is Milton, who never writes about one thing when he can write about 10 at once, a habit that he learned at least in part from Spencer, because this is Milton, he confronts his own loss fully. He takes comfort in the example of other blind prophets. He speaks to us and explains his method of composing at night and what that's like. He actually goes so far as to say that he's nourished by his own mind's ability to produce beautiful poetry with almost no effort at all. And he finishes by carrying those harmonious numbers, that's his name for his poetry, deep into the pain of his own darkness, and he finds there the gift of prophetic vision. Listen to this. Hail, holy light, offspring of heaven firstborn, or of the eternal, co-eternal beam, may I express thee unblamed? Since God is light, and never but in unapproached light, dwelt from eternity, dwelt then in thee, bright effluence of bright essence increate. Or hearest thou rather pure ethereal stream, whose fountain, who shall tell? Before the sun, before the heavens, thou wert, and at the voice of God, as with a mantle, didst invest the rising world of waters, dark and deep, one from the void and formless infinite. Thee I revisit now with bolder wing, escape the Stygian pool, though long detained in that obscure sojourn, while in my flight through utter and through middle darkness born, with other notes than to the Orphean lyre, I sung of chaos and eternal night, taught by the heavenly muse to venture down the dark descent, and up to reascend, though hard and rare. Thee I revisit safe, and feel thy sovereign vital lamp. But thou revisit'st not these eyes that roll in vain to find thy piercing ray and find no dawn. So thick a drop serene hath quenched their orbs, or dim suffusion veiled. Yet not the more cease I to wander where the muses haunt clear spring, or shady grove, or sunny hill, smit with the love of sacred song, but chief thee, Zion, and the flowery brooks beneath that wash thy hallowed feet and warbling flow. Nightly I visit, nor sometimes forget those other two equaled with me in fate, so were I equaled with them in renown, blind Thamyris and blind Maeonides and Tiresias and Phineas, prophets old. Then feed on thoughts that voluntary move harmonious numbers, as the wakeful bird sings darkling, and in shadiest covert hid tunes her nocturnal note. Thus with the year seasons return, but not to me returns day, or the sweet approach of even or morn, or sight of vernal bloom, or summer's rose, or flocks, or herds, or human face divine, but cloud instead, and ever-during dark surrounds me, from the cheerful ways of men cut off, and for the book of knowledge fair, presented with a universal blank of nature's works to me, expunged and raced, and wisdom at one entrance quite shut out. So much the rather thou, celestial light, shine inward, and the mind through all her powers irradiate. There plant eyes, all mist from thence purge and disperse, that I may see and tell of things invisible to mortal sight. Now open your eyes. What I'd like to do now is take Milton's biography and try to weave it into a map of Milton's imagination. Talk about what I take to be his artistic and intellectual mind and his imagination. Talk about Paradise Lost at the end. I take it that all his life he was sparked, inspired, obsessed by five main principles, what I'll call Milton's energizing principles. These are things he loved to think about, loved to write around. I'll give them to you in one order, though you could certainly put them in other orders, but I will save the most complex for last because I think it's going to be the real key to understanding some of what is especially interesting about Paradise Lost. The first energizing principle for Milton is beginnings, origins. He loved to think about that. Paradise Lost is an epic. Epics tell stories of origins. Milton told the story of the origin of the universe. Top that, he says to posterity. No one has yet. He told the story of the origin of history, of human civilization. At the end of Paradise Lost, Adam and Eve enter history and join us. His first public work, which he wrote when he was 21, doggone it, is The Ode on the Morning of Christ's Nativity. And it's a poem about origins. Christ's birth for Milton was the beginning of humanity's regaining that paradise from which it fell. For Milton, Christ's birth both intersects sacred history and re-originates it. At the center of the Ode on the Morning of Christ's Nativity, usually called the Nativity Ode for short, there's a moment where he's talking about beginnings and ends simultaneously, telling us that at the end of time, our bliss will be full and perfect, but at the Nativity, our bliss begins. In some respects, every beginning contains its end, and every end contains another beginning. Milton's fascinated by that. He's fascinated by the very act of starting. And through his whole life, politically, theologically, artistically, he's always trying to trace things back to their causes, to find their beginnings. So energizing principle one, beginnings, origins. Energizing principle two is loss. As we've already seen, Milton knew loss intimately. But even before his life collapsed around him, he was the greatest poet of loss in our language. Lycidas, a poem that we're not reading, but it's in your anthology, I recommend it to you, is often said to be the greatest elegy in the language. An elegy is a poem of loss, of mourning, and of some kind of redemption at the end. Milton certainly believed that his God could redeem loss, but he also believed, and this is interesting, and put him at odds with some other thinkers of the day, other theologians, he believed that redemption did not erase loss. Time was not just one thing after another to get you to the happy ending. Time had another role to perform. In fact, he was so bold as to say that there was motion in the heavens, which Aristotle denied, because Aristotle thought motion meant imperfection. Milton said, no, there's not only motion in the heavens, in heaven, in Paradise Lost, the angels have time for fun. They just get a kick out of sequence. Sort of a strange thing. Because Milton believes that redemption doesn't erase loss, his poetry can bring a great deal of comfort even to those who do not share his belief in the Judeo-Christian God. It's quite interesting to be at a Miltonist convention, which I've gone to many times, and in that group, you'll find people of every religious belief and many with none. And yet, Milton's emphasis on the way in which loss doesn't simply get erased by salvation speaks to every Miltonist I know. Quite astonishing that way. And of course, Paradise Lost has a follow-on. It has a sequel, Paradise Regained, but it's not what you think. Paradise Regained is a whole story of temptation, and it ends with the figure of Jesus going back to his mother's house privately. It's a very quiet ending. It's not as if suddenly there's a climactic battle and Old Scratch gets defeated for all eternity. It's just a human drama. Just trying to hold out, do the right thing. So, beginnings and origins, and loss. Two of the energizing principles Milton really likes to think about. They get his imagination going. Now here's one that has caused a great deal of commentary through the years. Milton is not only an ambitious poet, and there never was a more ambitious poet than Milton, he also likes to think about ambition. From an early age, he had mapped out all the major literary genres and made plans to write great works in each of them. And because he was Milton, a person of tremendous self-confidence, who seems unforgivably not to have been afflicted with any neurotic self-consciousness, he put his plans out there publicly, inviting skepticism and ridicule, and he made good on them, which really is unforgivable. He wrote tragedy. He wrote epic. He wrote brief epic. He wrote musical drama, what his age called a mask. He wrote pastoral elegy, sonnets, wrote odes. He wrote his great works in three different languages, Latin, Italian, and English. And he could read and speak almost all the modern continental languages, also Greek and Hebrew. And his ambition was of Promethean proportions, with all the splendor and risk and uneasiness that implies. Prometheus, you'll recall, stole fire from the heavens and was chained to a rock and had vultures eating his liver. So there you go, sort of the ultimate geek punishment. You could even say that Milton's ambition was of satanic proportion. Blake said that Milton was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it. I think Blake was almost there. I think Milton was certainly of the devil's party and did know it. But that's only part of the story. It turns out in Paradise Lost that Satan is not the most ambitious character. So, ambition, thinking about it. What does it mean to want more? What does it mean not to be satisfied with what one is, but to press toward what one might become? Is that sinful? Is it overreaching? Lots of examples of Renaissance overreachers, right? Dr. Faustus, a conspicuous example. Is Milton wrong to be so ambitious? Satan wrong to be ambitious? Adam and Eve wrong to be ambitious? For ambitious they are. And of course, Milton's God, foolishly ambitious, making a universe with free creatures in it, and then putting them in a garden with something they shouldn't do. Duh. So, beginnings and origins, loss, ambition. He also liked to think about delay or waiting. In some ways, this is how he thought about time. Time was pleasure in a kind of sequence, but time was also an interval between a beginning and between a kind of fulfillment. Ironically, Milton was both a prodigy and a late bloomer. Kind of a weird ambition to have. I don't know if he set out to do that, but it's the way it turned out. When the early bloom was over and the late bloom hadn't come, he was at first a bit worried. It may comfort you to know that when Milton was 23, he wrote a poem that asks, in a nutshell, what's wrong with me? I'm 23. I don't have a masterwork yet. What am I supposed to do now? He'd gone to graduate school, had his master's degree, but he hadn't made up his mind about what he would do next. In fact, what he did next, maybe you can try this if you're brave, he spent about 6 years in almost nonstop reading, a program of self-instruction subsidized by a father who was apparently getting a little impatient with his brilliant son towards the end. So Milton wrote his father a Latin poem called Ad Patrem, to my father, to explain what he was really up to, studying to become a great poet, thanking his dad for his financial support, and the poem he wrote to talk about why he hadn't yet finished reading was itself a great poem. So, Milton learns to be a great poet of action and a great poet of waiting. He mastered the art of waiting. One of his more famous lines, they also serve who only stand and wait. For him, waiting was a component of many of the greatest pleasures. You remember Andrew Marvell in To His Coy Mistress when he sounds the carpe diem, sees the day with a series of urgent nows, right? Now, now. Milton, by contrast, imagines that the best lovemaking is preceded by what he calls sweet, reluctant, amorous delay. Don't rush it, he says. Milton also imagines all of human history as a glorious act of patient and faithful waiting. No poet ever had a fuller or more subtle understanding of the relationship between the then of the past and the then of the future and the now in which we live. Isn't it funny we use then to point backwards and forward? I will have done it then. I did it then. Language. The now in which we live brings up the fifth and I think the most complex of Milton's energizing principles. And this is one I can't sum up in one or two words. So I got a flood of them coming, all right? So the fifth one is choice, alterity, decision. In The Faery Queen, there are all these moments of choice. Do I go this way or that way? Do I go into the rain or go out of the rain? Do I go with this person or that person? You know, things keep splitting into twos. So you keep getting these A or B, all right? Milton loved to think about the moment of fateful decision. He loved to think about the act of choosing. He thought about that moment in which you've assessed the best you can. You've gotten all the information you're going to get, but you haven't yet decided. That moment of fateful decision as the moment of purest freedom. And Paradise Lost is his greatest drama of choice and decision. Now, there's another word in there, in the middle, alterity. That's a philosophical word meaning otherness. And I put it in there because in that moment of fateful decision, you become very conscious, not just of resemblance, but of difference, of otherness. And that idea of otherness or alterity is very, very important to Milton. You'll see it in a number of ways. You see it certainly in the drama played out between Adam and Eve, who, though they are, I mean, they share DNA, but they exist in a relationship of otherness to each other. And what that otherness is, what it means, what we're to make of it, is one of the great critical discussions in Paradise Lost. Milton has varied ways of thinking about it. But it's not just between Adam and Eve. It's between human beings and angels. It's between human beings and God. At each of these levels of being in the poem, there is otherness to contend with. Angels and human beings can eat together. The angels have real appetite, but they don't excrete anything the way human beings do because they have perfect digestion. And they understand how all of the matter in the cosmos is on one continuum. Human beings are sort of learning that. But maybe one day human beings will be able to fly the way the angels can, etc. Every time these two different beings are brought together, certainly Adam and Eve, the most conspicuous example, they're confronted by their otherness. They're just not the same. And one of the great riddles of the poem is, how can this Miltonic God, who is all-powerful, everywhere, etc., create beings who are free and other? Are they really free? Are they really other? It's a difficult thing to take on. Milton thinks about it throughout Paradise Lost. That moment of choice is not just a moment of freedom, though. It's a moment of temptation. Milton is very interested in temptation. Temptation is, for Milton, that moment in which the alternatives present themselves with a kind of existential vividness so that you are able to inhabit those alternatives as fully as possible, making that choice as deliberate as possible. I'll give you an example. In a tract called Areopagitica, which is Milton arguing more or less for freedom of the press, he's not against censorship. He doesn't want it censored before it's published. He talks about how one should encounter vice. Now, we can imagine various ways of encountering vice. We can say, no, please, none for me, thank you very much. Or we can imagine indulging, or we can imagine sort of thinking about it and then not doing it, or whatever. Milton says, he that can apprehend and consider vice with all her seeming baits and pleasures, and yet abstain, and yet distinguish, and yet prefer that which is truly good, he is the true warfaring Christian. By which he means, you can't just have the idea in your head. You have to imagine it. Very, very interesting and risky for Milton, because, of course, there are some inconvenient parts in Scripture suggesting that if you think about it, you've already done it. Milton says, oh, you must think about it, otherwise your choice has no meaning. You say, right, I won't commit adultery, and you haven't given it a thought. It's like your default position is fidelity. It doesn't mean anything. So Milton pushes it. Milton wants temptation to be the cauldron of true freedom. And this is consistent for Adam and Eve, for Satan. It even seems to me that at times God tempts himself, which is truly perverse, but it happens. And the particular mode of temptation that is most intriguing to Milton, I would say, is the mode of provocation. He talks about the tree in the middle of the garden, the one that they're not supposed to eat from, as a provoking object. And he says it's almost ever in Adam's eye. Now that's interesting. It's not in the middle of his field of vision, where he's thinking about it all the time. It's not absent from his field of vision, where he doesn't have to confront it unless he happens to be walking by the center of the garden on a sunny day. It's on the periphery. It's always there as an alternative that he's engaging with, but never an overpowering alternative, but never absent. By calling it a provoking object, I think Milton's playing with a number of things. One of them is the actual meaning of the word provoke, which comes from the Latin provocare, which means to call forth. There's a way in which all of Paradise Lost is a laboratory of choice, which has a kind of soul-making design, bringing Adam and Eve into contact with a momentous ethical decision, which, because they can live with it, but cannot elude it, charges all of their ethical activity with meaning. It makes their choice to obey meaningful, and not just a default position. So, how does this go into Paradise Lost? At every stage, we're confronted by what we call cruxes. That means points of critical disagreement, puzzlement, conversation, things that become difficult to judge, but are great fun to think about. Crux is literally a cross. It's a place where, again, you're confronted with a kind of otherness, a moment of decision, and they multiply in Paradise Lost. I'll talk about Milton's Satan today, since he's pretty much the star of books 1 and 2. But it's not just Milton's Satan, you know, hero or fool, you know, somebody we're to admire, somebody we're to despise. Milton's God is a crux. There's a whole book written on Milton's God, a fellow named William Empson, who compared Milton's God to Joseph Stalin. Makes a very good argument, too. Milton's God is a crux. In fact, I would argue that the most dense part of the entire poem is in book 7, when Milton's God thinks about how he's going to create a universe out of himself, but nevertheless it's free and not him. It's compressed into a very few lines that critics have been arguing about for centuries. Milton's Adam is a crux. Milton's Eve is a special crux. There's a whole book written just on Milton's Eve. Lots of things to talk about there, as we will learn as we go forward. Milton's Paradise is also a crux, and it's one that started to receive even more attention over the last couple of decades. I'm really happy to see that, because it's a very peculiar place. Milton says it's wild above rule or art. That's a heck of a thing for a poet to say about paradise. It's overgrown. It's kind of out of control. He says enormous bliss. And enormous in the Renaissance had the force of abnormal, outside the bounds, excessive. Milton's a great poet of excess. He even has a description of angelic eating in heaven, where the only way they could overeat would be to eat more than they can eat, which, since they can't do that logically, they can never overeat, which is kind of cool. Doesn't work here on earth. Nevertheless, paradise is an interesting place. Adam and Eve are charged with tending it. The more they prune it, the more it grows. There's a tree of life. It's right next to the tree they're not supposed to touch. Eve goes to the tree she's not supposed to touch, yet sinless, Milton says. And it's lunchtime, and she's hungry, and it smells good. Ah! Why is paradise built this way? Why not have the tree in a kind of a bottle somewhere? Or why not say, you know, don't jump off a cliff? That'd probably be easy not to do, right? Why is eating such a big deal? There's a strand of Milton criticism now that goes by various names, eco-criticism. Sometimes it's linked with feminist analysis, ecofeminism, and a lot of really interesting work is being done on sort of the greening of Milton. What did Milton imagine as a harmonious ecology inside paradise. And because Milton is Milton, he actually has opinions on herbs and plants and animals, and he knows some of the science of this. It's really quite scary. Paradise Lost is an epic. In the midst of all of the cruxes, it's important to remember that. It has certain genre markers. As an epic, it includes all the other genres. It has tragedy, it has comedy, it has lyric. At times, Milton will even have things spelled out as an acrostic. At the beginning of the lines, you can see at one point Satan. So, as an epic, there's a hero. Think about who the hero is in Paradise Lost. Is it God? Is it Satan? Is it Eve? Eve is the first one to repent. When God comes down and asks Adam and Eve, "What did you do?" Eve says, "The serpent me beguiled and I did eat." Adam goes into this long-winded explanation about, "Well, there was this woman and blah, blah, blah," you know. It's really not Adam's finest moment. The setting is vast in scope. You can't imagine a vaster setting than Paradise Lost. Not only the created universe, but infinity. Milton was not afraid of infinity. A number of Renaissance philosophers did not like infinity, because infinity, especially if you ascribed it to the human mind, it seemed scary, arrogant, unknowable. An epic has action consisting of deeds of great valor. There's a whole war in heaven. But those aren't the only deeds of great valor. The other deeds of great valor as well, having to do with, again, repentance, separating in the midst of a tempter. And the style in an epic, Hugh Holman says, has sustained elevation and grand simplicity. Writing in iambic pentameter, unrhymed, blank verse, Milton was able to accomplish perhaps the most sustained example of elevation and grand simplicity in the language. It begins in the middle of things. We're in hell with Satan. In the middle of the action, we get flashbacks to what happened before, and we move forward into what happens afterwards. Like a great epic, there are invocations. Milton's are Christian, but they get interestingly conflated with classical invocations. He actually invokes a muse by name at the beginning of Book 7, Urania, the muse of astronomy. Book 7 is the story of the creation of the universe. And they come at 1 and 3 and 7. You heard the invocation to light today. And then the invocation, sing heavenly muse, at the beginning of Book 1 is probably the most famous. A couple of things to leave you with. I'm going to try to hurry through here because we're almost out of time. Remember that a reader of Milton must be always upon alert. I love this phrase. He is surrounded with sense. Milton will pun in two or three languages. Sometimes you get the weird acrostics. Sometimes it'll be a rhyme when you least expect it. Sometimes it'll be internal. Sometimes it'll be an end rhyme. You never know. It rises, it being sense, rises in every line. Every word is to the purpose. There are no lazy intervals. That doesn't mean it's perfectly consistent, and it doesn't mean that it will all make sense. I'm sure there are bits in there where Milton just nodded off. Sometimes even great Homer nods, we are told. I just haven't found them yet, which is a little vexing. So, for example, at the beginning, it's not just of man's disobedience, it's the first disobedience. And the fruit. In that first line, there's that fruit dangling of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste. Notice how fruit and taste are in near proximity. The word taste and the word test and the word tempt are all related etymologically. The rest of what I have there has to do with Satan and the eternal question of whether the devil is an ass or the devil is a hero. I propose a third way. That's my own perversity. I guess he would be a hass. I don't know. I just made that up. Think about this. It may be that Satan's great sin, finally, is not that he wrestles with God, but that he stops. And I'll see you Friday.